This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your State Society of CPAs for your personal, non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Request for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for September 23rd, 2013. We have five items this week, not as many as some weeks. The first, I wanted to be sure and comment again on the proposed regulations which are providing guidance on the dispositions of tangible depreciable property, including dispositions from general asset accounts. We talked a little bit more last week about the final regulations on the so-called tangible property or repair regulations. Then we have guidance on the application of Affordable Care Act provisions to health care arrangements, specifically health savings accounts, health reimbursement arrangements, employer reimbursement arrangements, and then Revenue Procedure 2013-34, in which the IRS provides guidance which is consistent with the proposed regulations we got back in August on equitable relief from tax liability for an innocent spouse. And then a couple of just interesting items. The first, tax enforcement revenue and employment are both down double digits, according to a report from the Treasury Inspector General, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And then the Treasury Inspector General discovered that the IRS is not properly documenting and enforcing the paid preparer penalty assessments. Now, that can only mean they're going to give increased attention to it, which can only mean trouble for us. So stay tuned. Here we go. These are proposed regulations providing guidance on dispositions of tangible depreciable property. The IRS intends to finalize these regulations before December 31st of this year. These are a companion to the tangible property final regulations issued last week, and these were not fully discussed. As you'll recall, Notice 2012-73, issued back in November of 2012, alerted all of us that the disposition rules in the temporary regs would be revised. Responding to several comments, IRS and Treasury, and most of the comments, by the way, regarded the disposition of structural components of a building. Roof. The roof has been a problem for everybody. Dispositions of assets in a general asset account. And how to determine the unadjusted depreciable basis of a disposed asset in a multiple asset or general asset account. Treasury and the IRS disagreed with a lot of the suggestions from commentators that the use of the general asset account should be a default rule, but they agreed that some relief was called for, and so that what they have done is that taxpayers who do not elect the general asset account treatment will still have the same flexibility to forego a loss upon the disposition of a structural component as taxpayers who have elected the general asset treatment. And one of the reasons that we were going to elect general asset treatment was to have that kind of flexibility. The proposed regs also provide that a building, condominium, cooperative, including the structural components of each, is the asset for disposition purposes. They also provide that the disposition rules at Regulation 1.168 (i)(8) apply to a partial disposition of an asset. The proposed regulations do not retain the rule in the temporary regulations at 1.168 (i)-1t. and 1.168 (i)-8t that allows taxpayers to use, quote, any reasonable, consistent method to treat an asset's components as the asset for disposition purposes. The problem is, the partial disposition rule under the proposed regs allows taxpayers to treat the disposition of an asset's components as a disposition. The temporary regs provide that if a disposed asset is in a general or multiple asset account or a component of a larger asset and it is not practical to determine the unadjusted depreciable basis, the taxpayer can use any reasonable method. What we get in these proposed regs are some examples of what reasonable methods are. That's what we needed. Finally, the proposed rules provide that if a taxpayer disposes of a portion of an asset and the partial disposition rule applies to that disposition, the taxpayer must account for the disposed portion in a single asset account beginning in the tax year in which the disposition occurs. So you would move, for example, you would move part of a building into a separate asset account. How that's going to work? Fortunately, we got 44 pages of a little bit of text and a lot of examples. Next, we have guidance on the application of Affordable Care Act provisions to health care arrangements. This notice 2013-54, issued on September 13th, addresses the application of the so-called market reform and other provisions of the Affordable Care Act to health reimbursement arrangements, HRAs, employer payment plans, and health flexible spending arrangements, health FSAs. HRAs and FSAs are generally considered to be group health plans if you have two or more participants. Employer payment plans are group health plans under which an employer reimburses an employee for some or all of the premium expenses incurred for an individual health insurance policy. Under that guidance, an employer payment plan does not include an employer-sponsored arrangement under which an employee may choose cash or an after-tax amount to be applied toward health coverage. The market reform provisions addressed in the guidance are that a group health plan may not establish any annual limit on the dollar amount of benefits for any individual, and that non-grandfathered group health plans must provide some preventive services without imposing any cost-sharing arrangements for the services. The notice goes on to provide guidance in the form of questions and answers on the integration of a health reimbursement arrangement with a group health plan. A health reimbursement arrangement will be integrated with a group health plan for purposes of the annual dollar limit prohibition and the preventive services requirements only if it meets the requirements under either of the two integration methods that are described in the notice. The notice also describes how the market reforms apply to a health flexible spending arrangement that does not qualify as an accepted or an excluded benefit. Guidance is also provided on Code Section 125F3, which are employee assistance programs. The IRS intends to amend the applicable rules under Section 9831. By the way, this guidance addresses Code Section 9831, Code Section 9832, Code Section 125F3. The guidance provides that a health reimbursement arrangement that has fewer than two participants that's a pretty skinny, that's one, right? Who are current employees on the first day of the plan year is considered minimum essential coverage for purposes of Section 5000A and 36B, and it tells you what the terms have to be in order to consider that for minimum essential coverage. I believe I mentioned that the guidance is provided in question and answer format. The notice is 13 pages as I print it, and most of that 13 pages is taken up with 12 questions and answers. Next, Revenue Procedure 2013-34. This follows the proposed regulations published on August the 13th, discussed in one of these programs at that time, regarding the revised rules for spouses requesting equitable relief from tax liability. The revenue procedure gives greater weight to the presence of abuse when its presence affects the analysis of other factors. It goes on to provide that under the timely threshold condition, a request for equitable relief must be filed before the expiration of the period of limitation for collection under 6502 or the period of limitation for credit or refund under 6511. Now, it's a three-year statute. 6502 is a three-year statute. 6511 is a two-year statute. The two-year statute runs from time of payment. The three-year statute runs from time of filing, whichever of those is applicable. The attribution threshold condition adds a new exception to the requirement that the income tax liability be attributable to an item of the non-requesting spouse. Relief would not be precluded for an item attributable to the requesting spouse if the non-requesting spouse's fraud gave rise to the understatement of tax or deficiency. In other words, if there's enough tax paid to cover the tax liability of the requesting spouse, but because the non-requesting spouse was engaged in a fraudulent transaction, that caused the tax liability to be greater, the tax liability related to the income of the requesting spouse can actually be the subject of equitable relief. Streamlined determinations of equitable relief under Section 66C or 6015F also now can apply to understatements of tax in understatements of income tax instead of only underpayments. If a requesting spouse is not entitled to a streamlined determination, the requesting spouse may still be considered for relief under equitable factors, and Revenue Procedure 2013-34 clarifies that. Specifically, no one factor or a majority of factors necessarily controls the determination. The economic hardship factor includes minimum standards. A lack of finding of economic hardship will be a neutral factor, not a negative factor. The guidance also goes on to clarify that the knowledge factor works in understatement cases involving equitable relief and in underpayment cases. Goes on to clarify that the legal obligation factor, the significant benefit factor, the compliance with income tax laws factor, and as a requesting spouse's subsequent compliance with all federal tax laws are now factors that may weigh in favor of relief. And now to the Treasury Inspector General reports. IRS enforcement revenue and employment are both down double digits. Well, let's see what that means. The IRS estimates a total tax gap of $500 billion. All of the IRS employees, all the officers, all the agents, all the clerks working together managed to collect $50 billion of that. By my math, that's 10%. The other 90% goes uncollected. No matter, it seems, how many agents and officers we add, the IRS is still unable to close that gap. One might reasonably think, then, that the system needs reform so that the gap is less susceptible to the mendacious nature of the American taxpayer. In fiscal 2010 and 11, the IRS hired only 200 revenue agents and tax compliance officers. In 2009 and 10, they hired 3,300. And of course, there are people leaving the service all the time. The reduced hiring has contributed to a 13% reduction in the overall number of examination function personnel who conduct examinations of tax returns. In January 2012, the IRS estimates the tax gap at $450 billion, that's after they collected their 50, up 30% from an estimate of $345 billion in 2001. The IRS, of course, is complaining about the hiring freeze, and the public and their elected representatives, of course, are complaining about what seems to be some wrong-headed work in the IRS. The IRS is going to have trouble in this Congress getting the funding it needs. The bottom line is, with that kind of a tax gap and that kind of an inefficient collection system, no matter how you fund the collection effort, the message is clear. Reasonable, thoughtful tax reform should be the top priority in Washington, D.C., and of course you and I know that it is not. Finally, in 2009, 10, and 11, this is a Treasury Inspector General report number 2013-30-075. In which the Inspector General reports that managers did not properly approve prepare penalty assessments in 8 of a statistical sample of 98 Section 6694 prepare penalty cases. It's about a 14% error rate. If the managers do not properly approve and the revenue agents do not properly prepare, then it's impossible for the IRS to pursue and litigate those assessments and to enforce the penalties. 2,345 cases were closed in the three-year period, 2009, 10, and 11, and involved 9.35 million in preparer penalties, a simple average of $4,000 each, but we know that some of them were in the tens of thousands, and so some of them must have also been minimal. In those 8 cases, the immediate managers did not properly approve $19,000 in preparer penalty assessments as required. That lack of proper approval hinders the IRS's ability to successfully litigate the penalty assessments in court if that becomes necessary. IRS quality examiners found that examiners did not always adequately document the examination case files with the facts that supported whether or not they considered paid preparer penalties. Current enforcement practices do not treat paid preparers with unpaid penalties as a priority, which could easily impact whether the penalties achieve their intent of changing preparer behavior. So what did the Treasury Inspector General recommend? That the Internal Revenue Manual be updated? That improvements be implemented? That special training be dedicated to the issue of preparer penalties? What does that mean to you and to me. It means that revenue agents are going to begin doing what the law requires them to do, and that is, in any situation where there is an assessment of additional tax, they must consider whether or not the preparer was at fault. How do we do that? Well, we determine whether the preparer signed a return with a return position that did not have substantial authority, or if it did not have substantial authority, was it properly disclosed? Your defense against a preparer penalty and a defense against a penalty assessed on your client is the Form 8275, and we all need to be more diligent in considering whether or not a return position has substantial authority. And then, if it does not, does it have a reasonable basis? And if you believe it has a reasonable basis, then you must include a Form 8275 in the return explaining why you believe that. To quote a Commissioner Shulman, the Internal Revenue Service, recently retired from his duty segment, Commissioner Shulman said that taxpayers and the IRS should not be playing hide-and-seek. We heartily support that view. Thank you for joining me this week, and remember, stay safe.